One Sunday morning, the preacher noticed that little Alex was standing and staring at a plaque that hung in the foyer of the building. The plaque was covered with several names and small American flags by each name. The seven-year-old had been staring at the plaque for some time, so the preacher walked up and stood beside the small boy and said quietly, "Good morning, Alex." "Good morning," replied the young man, still focused on the plaque. "Mr. McGee, what is this?" "Well, Alex, it's a memorial to all the young men and women who died in the service." Soberly, the two stood there and looked at the plaque for some time. Little Alex's voice was barely audible when he looked up at Mr. McGee and said, "What service, the AM or PM?" I like that story. Alex has been instructed it's important to be at services, but he isn't too sure it's something he's willing to die for yet. I want to welcome everybody this morning. If you're visiting with us, we're especially glad that you're here. Henry Ward Beecher was a notable preacher of the 19th century. One Sunday morning, he was became ill and wasn't able to preach, so a substitute preacher got up to preach in his place. As members of the congregation saw that Mr. Beecher wasn't going to be preaching that day, they got up to leave. When the substitute preacher saw this, he said, "Anybody who is here to worship Mr. Beecher may leave, but if you're here to worship the Lord, you can stay in your seat." Fortunately, nobody's getting up right now, so hopefully nobody also is here to worship Mark, but I know we're probably all disappointed. I know I am that Mark is not here to preach today. Lord willing, he'll be back on Tuesday with Judy, and he'll be able to pick up his preaching duties at that time. I want to take just a few minutes this morning, though, to look at a couple of men in the Bible, specifically two men that were present at the time of Jesus' trial and crucifixion. I'll start this morning by looking at Peter. Peter was a righteous man who really did love the Lord, and he really tried to do what's right. So how could it happen that somebody with such sincere motives could find himself at such a point of failure as Peter did? None of us would dispute that when Peter denied Jesus, he'd hit rock bottom. My concern is this: if it could happen to Peter, then it could happen to any of us. So let's take a look this morning at Peter and see what he needed to change in his life and what allowed this to happen. I want to pick up the story of Peter much earlier than the denial, though, because I believe that he'd already had begun a downward spiral in his life well before the time of the denial. If you would turn in your Bibles to Matthew 16, we'll set the scene there. I want to start here because I think it gives us an idea of where Peter had fallen from. Matthew 16, let's start in verse 13. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" So they said, "Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." If verses 18 and 19 of our context here give Peter some sort of special authority, that authority would only have functioned if he was speaking from God's wisdom, not if he was speaking from human or even demonic wisdom. But Peter, we'll find that's not going to be the case with Peter here in just a second. So how did the downward slide in Peter's life begin? Continue reading with me in verse 20. We read 20 through 23. Then he commanded his disciples that they should tell no one that he was Jesus the Christ. From that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders
and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised the third day. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, Far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, Get behind me, Satan, you are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but of the things of men. Peter takes issue with Jesus saying that he's going to need to suffer and die. And I'm confident that if any of us were present at this time, we would have had the same objection. If not verbally, as Peter expressed, at least internally, we would have thought, no, Jesus, that cannot be right. It's not human wisdom to think about suffering and death by your leader as actually being a victory. No reasonable person would look at Abraham Lincoln and think that the cause of the Union would be better off without him around. Likewise, we wouldn't look at Martin Luther King Jr. and think that the Civil Rights Movement would be better off without him. That's not reasonable thinking for us, is it? And it wasn't reasonable for Peter either. Because he, in verse 22, he looks at Jesus and it says that Peter rebuked Jesus for saying that he would suffer and die. He rebuked him. Well, this first step in a downward slide, I believe, is a big one. I believe it's when we find ourselves in where Peter found himself, standing in opposition to God. Jesus has said to Peter, Get behind me, Satan. And that must have come as quite a shock to Peter, I would imagine, that those words would come out of Jesus' mouth. Well, there's no doubt that Peter was out of line for taking Jesus aside and rebuking him. But he was more than just out of line. He was acting as the devil's agent. Consider this. When Jesus was being tempted by Satan in Matthew chapter 4, Satan was offering to Jesus the kingdom without having to go through the suffering of the cross, to which Jesus responded, Away with you, Satan. So now Peter is offering Jesus the same temptation. And Jesus uses very similar words when he tells Peter, Get behind me, Satan. So is it possible that the devil has influenced our world so deeply that the world's values are often the devil's values? I don't think any of us would probably disagree that doesn't happen at times. But valuing things that human beings value, like the lack of suffering, Peter shows himself to be in opposition to God and be in agreement with the devil at this time. Have you ever found yourself to be in opposition to God? Usually it happens when God doesn't do things the way that we think that he should do things. And that's where Peter finds himself. He's not in agreement with what needs to happen here. It's interesting to me, though, as you read through the rest of the book of Matthew, the next several chapters, at least, of the book of Matthew, that seems like every time you see Peter's name mentioned, he's out of step or not seeing things eye to eye with Jesus. Look at Matthew 17, starting in verse 1. Verse 1 is going to tell us that it was only 6 days ago that Peter said, Get behind me, Satan. And I don't know what those 6 days would have been like for Peter, but I bet they were 6 long days, and I bet he spent a lot of time wondering, what just went wrong? Read with me in verse 1. Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, led him up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. So Peter's had 6 long days. Now he finds himself on a mountain with Jesus, and he's witnessing this extraordinary event. And then Moses and Elijah show up. So just to put that into a modern context for us, that would be like if you're having a conversation, well, for me, George Brett, or maybe Albert Pujols, when all of a sudden Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio show up. So if you're a young boy or a baseball fan and you've got those three guys in your backyard, it'd be hard not to want to play catch with all of them. And I don't mean to trivialize what's happening here, but I think it puts it in a good light for us because Peter, I think, is going to display a very boy-like or childish quality in his response. Look at verse 4 with me. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. So 6 days ago, Peter had gotten out of step with Jesus, and he's getting carried away again. Read verse 5. While he was still speaking, Peter was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him. Peter rightfully finds importance in Jesus, and he wants to build a tabernacle for Jesus, but he misses the point because he wants to build a tabernacle for Moses and Elijah as well. He sees their importance and says, let me build a tabernacle for all three of you. So Jesus is standing right in front of him, but he misses the point that the Savior, it's his Savior that's right in front of him. Well, let's look at another story. Once again, Peter tries to approach Jesus, and he's probably thinking that he's got it figured out. Peter's thinking, and I can even hear him saying this to some of his other disciples, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to pose a question to Jesus, and before he has an opportunity to answer, I'm going to answer it for him. And my answer is going to be so good, it's just going to blow him away. You can just see the wheels turning in Peter's head. So look at Matthew 18, verse 21. Then Peter came to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times? So he said, Lord, look at me. Look, I'm willing to forgive my brother seven times. Can you believe what a good guy I am? And I can just see Peter envisioning Jesus saying, wow, Peter, you really are a good guy. I wish I wouldn't have been so hard on you a couple days ago. But that's not what happened, is it? Jesus didn't respond that way. Jesus responded and said, Peter, you think seven times is a lot, but I tell you it's 70 times seven. Well, once again, Peter's plan had been foiled. Several times now, Peter's found himself out of step and in opposition to God. And probably like most of us, he would have begun to pull back from God. But what happens when we pull back from God? I believe that there is an increase in self-reliance and a decrease in God-reliance. When we know things aren't completely right between us and the Lord, we begin to pull back from Him and we're reluctant to lean on Him the way that we should. Turn over to Matthew 26. Well, what do we love about Peter? He's always willing to speak up and say something, isn't he? It's going to happen again here in Matthew 26, 30, starting in verse 31. We'll read 31 through 33. Then Jesus said to him, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the shepherd of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. Peter answered and said to him, even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. Peter's quite sure that regardless of how the other disciples may react, even if they flake out on him and they just desert him, that's not going to happen to Peter. Even if the going gets rough, Peter's going to be the one that stays there by Jesus' side. It's interesting to me that sometimes our natural strengths can become points of weakness for us. And why is that, I wonder? I think it's because we spend years leaning on our strengths when we should be, and depending upon our strengths when we should be depending on God's strength. We're far more likely to lean on God when we're aware of a weakness in our life. But when we have a strength, we tend to depend on that as opposed to God. Well, in comparison to most people, though, Peter wasn't easily intimidated. So he begins to boast of his strength as opposed to God's strength. It's a self-reliance in Peter as opposed to a God-reliance. Well, good. Drop down a couple of verses with me to verse 36. Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me." And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "What? Could you not watch with me an hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter in temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And then that goes on to happen two more times. So what usually follows self-reliance?
Prayerlessness.
And that's the case here with Peter. Luke tells us that Peter and the other disciples were sleeping from sorrow. But when
Peter and the others should have been praying,
they were sleeping. And Peter had just told Jesus that, "I'm willing to die with you." And I don't think it's a coincidence that here in the garden, Jesus tells Peter, "I'm sorrowful even to the point of death." But what does Peter do? He falls asleep. So because Peter hasn't been praying, the downward slide continues in his life. When the mob arrives just a few minutes later, Peter draws his sword and he strikes the servant of the high priest. His intentions are good, but he goes about it in the wrong way. Peter responds to the threat by drawing his sword and hacking away at the problem. And that's usually what we do. When we're not walking with God, we usually just hack away at the problem. So right there in front of everybody, Jesus rebukes Peter again. And not only does he rebuke him, but he reverses the very act that Peter had just done by healing Malchus' ear. So Peter's been giving it his best shot over the past several days, but nothing's working out for him. He doesn't know what to do in this situation. So when the mob takes Jesus, he flees with the other disciples. Peter's very discouraged. He's been trying and nothing's working out for him. Have you ever been there in that situation where Peter finds himself? Can you understand what Peter must have been feeling at this moment in his life? Hopefully we can put the context of his denial into this story of his life. Because the denial didn't happen in a vacuum. It happened to a disciple who was very discouraged. A disciple who needed to make change, definitely. Well, unfortunately for Peter, he hasn't hit the bottom yet. Peter finds himself in the courtyard of the high priest and where Jesus is being tried. And this first temptation for him to deny Jesus is going to come from a very unexpected source and in a very unexpected way. It's going to be a servant girl who questions him. Would you think Peter, given the self-reliant state that he has been in for a while now, expected to be questioned by the servant girl? I doubt that Peter even gave it a second thought as he replied to the girl. It just would have been really easy for him to deny Jesus to the girl. This first temptation was, I think, very subtle to Peter. And he probably justified it in his mind somehow. But regardless, he's got a problem now. He's portrayed himself to this group as an innocent bystander. So when the second temptation comes, it's going to be even harder for him to reverse the course that he started. Peter tries to blend in with this crowd that we're told was ungodly. He stands by the fire like everybody else. And he makes small talk as the chief priests and the elders and the council seek out those to give false testimony about Jesus. That's going on around him, and Peter is just standing there like everybody else. He's trying to fit in with the world, but he knows in his heart that he shouldn't be in the world. Have you ever found yourself in that situation? Peter must have felt so much turmoil going on in his life as he stood there in that situation. And then it happens again. Another servant girl approaches him and questions him about being a follower of Jesus. So he's already denied it to one servant girl. So if he's going to keep the lie going, if he's going to be any good to Jesus at some point, he's got to keep the lie going now, he reasons in his head. After all, it's just a couple of servant girls who are questioning him. So he does it again. He denies him again, slipping further and further away from Jesus. Finally, a relative of Malchus, insists that he is a follower of Jesus. If Peter says yes, he surely going to pay for it. So he can't simply deny it this time. The pressure is too great with this accusation. So he begins to curse and to swear, saying, "I do not know the man." Peter had just done the very thing that he could have never dreamed that he would do. He just denied Jesus three times. Someone once said that sin will take you further than you want to go and cost you more than you want to pay. And I believe that's where Jesus found himself at this very moment. So the moment the rooster had crowed, Jesus turned and looked into Peter's eyes. And I can only speculate as to what that look must have been like. I don't think it was a look of anger. I don't think it was an "I told you so" type of look. I can only imagine that it was a look of pure love and compassion that he had for Peter. There Peter was, cursing and swearing, hanging out with the wrong crowd and denying him three times. And the look that Jesus gives Peter, I can only imagine would have melted Peter's heart. Over in Luke 22, verse 31 and 32 says, "Simon, Simon, indeed, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." Satan had indeed sifted him like wheat. Let's look, secondly and briefly, at the criminals who were crucified with Jesus. Back in Matthew 27, let's read 38 through 44. "Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and another on the left. And those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, 'You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross.' Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and elders, said, 'He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God, let him deliver him now, if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God.' Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing." So let's just look briefly at what we can know about the robbers. There's some things that we can know about them. The fact that they were being crucified in this way means that they were the lowest of low. They were the vilest of vile in that society. A brief study of the word that's used to describe them helps us understand the character of the men. Matthew and Mark describe the men as robbers. And in the Greek, that would have been a much more serious offense, although most scholars would agree that it wasn't a capital crime at that time. So the fact that they had been sentenced to death by crucifixion must have meant that they were guilty of additional crimes, probably most likely murder, while they were committing their crimes. Some commentators have connected them to the criminal Barabbas that we read about. I don't know that it's important to know whether they were his accomplices or not, but we know that these are men that would have had no regard for human life. Luke uses a different word to describe them, though. And then in the New King James Version, the word is interpreted criminal. But in the King James Version, the word is malefactor. That's a compound word meaning evil and work. And it would just quite literally mean an evil worker. So Luke wanted us to understand that these were the type of men that went about planning and committing evil deeds. Both of these criminals were equally guilty and equally wicked. Both of them would have had the same unbelieving and unbiblical and a blasphemous view of Jesus in the hours leading up to his crucifixion. And then you find that the robbers are offering Jesus the same temptation that he's been offered now. They're offering him the kingdom without the cross. They say, "Let him come down from the cross and we'll believe him." Well, both of the criminals felt that way, that is, until one of them, something happened in them. We're not told what it is or when it happened, but we know that it did happen. Look at Luke 23. Starting in verse 39. Then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him, saying, "If you are the Christ, save yourself and us." But the other answered, rebuking him, saying, Do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, Assuredly, I say to you today, you will be with me in paradise. One criminal got it, and one of them didn't. The penitent criminal recognized that there was an injustice of the situation going on. They deserved to be there. He realized that Christ did not. But he didn't see it as a failure. He saw it as a victory. That's such a significant change for this man. But consider the things that he would have seen. He would have seen Jesus' amazing words to the daughters of Jerusalem just a few minutes ago. He would have seen that. And while at the time they may not have meant much, I bet while he was hanging on the cross, he was thinking about Jesus' warnings. He would have also seen the Savior interceding for his people, saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Would have been drastically different than what the criminal would have expected. He was hurling insults at everybody, and here Jesus is saying, Forgive them, for they know not what they do. Whatever it was, he was moved so deeply that it changed him. He said, Remember me when you come into your kingdom. The criminal led a life of sin and recklessness, but he found himself in the same situation as Peter, as needing at the cross, that they were needing Jesus. But we're no better than Peter or the criminal. There's no question that their failures were great, but we know that in our hearts we're in the same situation. If you remember the words of Isaiah, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. I wish I could put it all on Peter or all on the criminal, but I know that I'm just as guilty as they are. In the New Testament, the word worthy or worth basically refers to weight. It refers to a time when people did business with coins that were minted with the exact amount of metal that the coin declared to be its value. So to put it in our thinking, a $20 gold coin contained exactly $20 worth of gold. However, the coins, as they were used repeatedly, they were subject to wear. So as they were passed from hand to hand, a coin lost some of its value because it lost some of its weight. It lost some of its worthiness. Coins would often be weighed to show that they were insufficient or lacking. So the point that I hope that you take home from the lesson today is that Jesus does not view us that way, as a coin who has lost value to him. Jesus saw Peter and the criminal as somebody worth dying for. Likewise, he sees you and he sees me as somebody worth dying for. You might consider yourself to be like a coin that's lost value. But I can assure you that Jesus does not see you that way, and I can prove it. If you would, in closing, turn over to John chapter 13 with me. We've looked at Peter a lot today, but I want to go back and just read a couple of verses real quick, starting in verse 36. John 13, verse 36. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus answered him, Where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow me afterward. Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for your sake. Jesus answered him, Will you lay down your life for my sake? Most assuredly, I say to you, the rooster shall not crow till you have denied me three times. Well, that's the end of that story, right? Somebody put a big chapter 14 there, and so we view this as the end of that story, and then chapter 14 starts another story. But I want us to go back and read this again, starting with verse 30, and let's read it the way that the early Christians would have read this. Verse 38, Will you lay down your life for my sake? Most assuredly, I tell you that the rooster shall not crow till you have denied me three times. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And where I go, you know, and the way you know. Well, that's the message
that I think is for us this morning. That Jesus had just told Peter he was going to deny him three times, but then he says, "Let not your heart be troubled." And that's, I think, something that I don't want for us to miss. Let not your heart be troubled. Jesus finds you as somebody worth dying for. If you're subject to the invitation, to God's invitation, if there's anything that this congregation can do for you at this time, we would ask that you'd come forward as we stand and sing.